makes a character great, the kind of character that you want to follow from book to book or movie to movie or show episode to show episode. Well, today we're talking about it with Bonnie Johnston and Shannon Valenzuela, and this is a great episode, chock full of information.
Write, publish, repeat, it echoes through the air. A chorus for creators, a call to those who dare. With cookies as his compass and a pen that won't retreat, he journeys through the pages. Write, publish, repeat.
Hello and welcome to Write, Publish, Repeat. It is the third episode, and today, you know, we're taking things back to basics, and today we're talking about how do I make great characters and structure my story. And our guests today are Bonnie Johnston and Shannon Valenzuela. And Sean will now introduce you to Shannon, who you are first meeting.
Well, actually, Dave's just meeting Shannon for the first time right now also, right, Dave?
Yes.
Yes. Okay, so I met Shannon in November, and we share a manager. Spencer is our manager, and I love Spencer. I think he's one of my favorite people in the world, and I totally trust him with my career. So Shannon apparently does also. And Spencer just sent an email and said, hey, Shannon is going to Author Nation, and she was wondering if you guys can have coffee or something. Of course, absolutely. That's great. But it was like 5 minutes after talking to Shannon that I was like, oh, this is cool. There's more here. And for those of you who, you know, have been swallowed by my vortex before, actually, everyone on this call.
So, we all drank the Kool-Aid.
Right. Just a big pitcher for us all. But it's the same thing. I mean, with Shannon, it was great because you have someone here who could talk theory, which is great. Like, I love that. And this community is full of that. People who can, you know, talk the talk. But then you also got the walk, you know, because Spencer said, basically, this is how, I don't know if you know this, Shannon, I probably told you this already, but how Spencer introduced you to me was, she is a phenomenal writer. And she's going to be big someday. And she's got these great pilots. But what those of you listening at home might not know is that it's very, very hard to sell a TV pilot unless you're willing to sign over your life to TV and be in the writer's room and you have the experience enough to be a showrunner. And so we thought, oh, well, there's a couple of ways that Shannon and I can work together. We could actually write a book and create IP for one of these exceptional scripts, which is what we're going to be doing. And also we could create something, you know, so Bonnie and I have been talking a lot about doing some more craft focused things, and you know, where Dave and I over here are focused on the commerce of story. The craft of story is something we never want to lose sight of, and Bonnie and I have actually done a substantial amount of content that no one's ever seen outside of our own studio. And there's other things we want to do, like writing cohorts, and actually script classes is something I'm really, really excited about in the not too distant future. But as me and Bonnie, like, our queue just keeps getting bigger and bigger and bigger, and this craft idea keeps getting further and further away. And Shannon was just like kind of a godsend in that she could come in and be a part of the actual craft and the actual production of what makes us all so like vibrant around here, but also help the community and teach and do some of the other those limbs that we want. So a very, very welcome, Shannon, to the podcast and to the family. And as I did last week, I think I did a pretty good job of shutting up and getting out of Bonnie's way. I'm going to do the same thing this week.
Well, thank you for that introduction. I'm so excited to be here with you all and get to talk about one of my favorite topics. So yeah, thank you.
Okay. All right. Well, let's start with what is the most important thing to consider when you're writing a story? What's the most important thing to consider with your characters? Like, where should you start?
Such a good question. Bonnie, I'm not sure. Like, Bonnie, do you want to jump in? Do you want me to jump in?
Go ahead.
Is great. Okay. So yeah, when I'm creating characters, for me, one of the most important things to really think about is the character's truly like their backstory. Where are they coming from? But it's not just backstory. I like to call it like the difference between like a mugshot and somebody's, the narrative of somebody's life. You know, when you're meeting, so like when Sean and I met at Author Nation, for example, you know, it's, you don't just get like, what color are your eyes? Like, what color is your hair? Like, what, you know, those are potentially important details, right? But what we really, really want to know about a character is what motivates them, right? Why are they here right now? What are they doing? And what's bothering them, right? What's not right with their world as it is? What are they looking to solve in their life? And we can kind of unlock some of their personality traits and some of the quirks by kind of digging into how they've handled situations in the past. What kinds of things get them really excited? What kinds of things really like hack them off? You know, what's, and how do they respond in those kinds of situations, right? Everyone kind of has their own sort of way of responding to those things. So I kind of love to dig into its backstory, its personality a little bit, because those are the things, right, that are going to put that character into relationship, but also into conflict with other characters. And as we know, conflict is like the engine of stories. So we want conflict. We want to find people who are juicy and like have a lot of stuff going on in the background.
So what's a good way to demonstrate either personality or backstory without exposition dump? Like in your opening scene on either a book or a show or whatever, we're just meeting this person. How do you introduce what makes them special and make the person care that's reading or watching?
I think that's another really great question, because I mean, I see this with a lot of sort of newer writers that we can have that tendency, right, to want to like info dump backstory information. But I think that, the better way is to put them in a situation where we're asking them to respond. Right. And they're going to respond, if you know them well, you've kind of done your homework on the back end, they're going to respond in a certain way in that scenario, right? They're, you know, if for example, let's say, you know, someone walks into a coffee shop and you know, the person in front of them in line turns around and spills the coffee all over this particular person. There are so many different ways that that person could respond to what has just happened.
They could end up in a trunk.
Yeah. We hope not. I mean, they haven't gotten their coffee yet. So, I mean, potentially, it depends on, you know. But yeah, I mean, there's so many ways, right, that person could respond in that instance, that it gives us a little bit of like a window or an insight into who they are. How do they respond when things don't go the way that they expect, you know? So I like to think about it that way. I like to put them in a situation where we can immediately kind of start to see their personality shine through, right? Give them a conversation, give them an action, give them something that's happening to them, and then have them just sort of put that on display, put their personality
in
on
your
display.
Script. So scripts are great because you have to do a lot of like very strategic work, because it's all show, no tell. Like, you can't tell anything. If it's not visually represented on the page, then you have failed on that page. And so you did, or I mean, it could be audible also, because yep. I'm about to become a dirty liar if it has to be visual. So in your pilot, there's music that the character is listening to as we open up, and that tells us it's specific music. It's not just like the script could have had music that's kind of playing in the background, but it's not. It's music that this person is listening to, because the kind of music a person listens to actually tells us a lot about them. And so little shorthand pieces like that, I think, are really helpful for the reader or the audience, if they're watching, to understand the character. But I think it's also helpful for us as creators to make those decisions, because it helps us to, it informs who the character is, and then we can kind of stick with them once we know.
So you're saying if you have an action hero, you shouldn't introduce them listening to like Yakety Sax, the Benny Hill theme?
You could, if it's like, I mean, actually, I think that would be amazing. It's just, what are you trying to say? Joel and I have a script that we wrote for a book that Johnny and I wrote called The Target, and it's two brothers who are in an insane asylum, but they're assassins. That would be actually a really amazing way to maybe open a scene there. So I don't think there's anything you can't do. I think you have to if you want to come up with something zany, and you know me, I love a zany idea, but the zanier the idea, the harder you have to work to prove it to the audience, and not you're, so it's not just you're wasting their time or it's all about the idea. It really always has to be about the character, even if the idea is bonkers.
Now, do you take this, the way we're introducing the main character, do you do the same thing with the antagonist, or do you do it slightly different?
I think it really kind of depends on what's going to serve the story. What do we need to know? It really kind of comes down to what does the audience need to know, and when do they need to know it? So I think that just sort of depends on when we're seeing them. In what context are we seeing them? You know, yeah, I think the antagonist is a little, you can do a little bit, you can be a little bit more mysterious maybe with the antagonist in some ways, depending on when you're bringing them in, I think.
Okay, and when you're creating characters, do you like to figure out all the stuff, their backstory, all of that, and outline their whole arc from the very beginning?
So for me, especially coming out of the screenwriting world, I do a lot of work on the front end. And even with novels, when I work in novels, I tend to be an outliner. I tend to be someone who likes to work off of something that I can go back and reference with sort of the understanding that it's going to evolve over the course of, as the characters actually get put in motion, they tend to do stuff that I didn't plan for, just sort of the way that things go. But yeah, I do like to sit down. I do like to have... I like to know the characters well enough, right, when I hit the page. So I need to have some, like going back to that idea about, you know, kind of creating this backstory image or picture of this person so that I kind of know, at least as I'm getting into the story, getting them started, you know, I kind of have a plan for what's going to happen. I know when I set them in motion, I kind of have an idea of how this is going to go. So yeah, I do like to have some of that mapped out ahead of time for sure. I don't know that it's necessarily the entire arc, but I need to know a trajectory. I need to have a starting point, and I need to kind of like launch them in a certain direction so that I kind of know where we might land. Yeah.
And Bonnie, yeah, I imagine that like it's kind of impossible for you if you don't have the arc, right? Like character arc is so central for you that... nothing else, I mean, not that nothing else matters, but without that in place, kind of nothing else matters. Is that,
yeah, kind of. I use the character arc, and like Shannon was talking about, like if you know where they're going and you have an idea of what they want and what motivates them and you have the backstory, for me, like character arc really determines how the story is going to end, because it's not just about what happens at the end and like how it happens really determines based on how you want to trigger the conclusion of the character arc. And it's like, if I don't know what the character arc is, like I could make up an ending, but in terms of having emotional impact or having it actually matter, like I absolutely have to know like what that change is going to be, so I know how everything that happens in the last act is going to be pushing the character towards that moment of change.
This is a question for both of you. Are there tells, like when you're watching or reading, but you're experiencing a story and the storyteller is a little sloppy, and they basically have decided that this thing needs to happen, and so the character is just like is not consistent with who you believed they were established at. Like, what are the certain tells? Can you see it coming ahead of time? Are there certain things that, well, here's how you could have avoided that?
Yeah, usually you can tell that that's going to happen. Usually you can tell that's going to happen because things that happen even earlier in the story are happening without there being like a really clear connection to character motivations. And like the causality will be weak, and it'll all be externally focused. It'll be like, oh, this happened because these things are happening in the world, but you won't actually see the character being active and making decisions that make a difference. And I don't know about you, Shannon, but like, When I see it, suddenly hit, it is like, it feels like a plot hole to me, because it's like, you can see the strings and like the character has become a puppet, right?
Yes. Yeah. I had a story coach one time who said that's like writer agenda is like showing up. Like the writer's agenda is like literally just front and center. You can just tell exactly what you're saying. You feel the puppet strings moving. And I was going to say exactly the same thing as Bonnie did about character reactivity, that if you notice that stuff is happening to the character and they are having to react, but they're not actually driving what's going on, they're not actually making those choices, that can be a big sign. I find as a writer, my characters sometimes will tell me, this sounds crazy, but just it's a writer thing, I suppose. But if I'm writing a scene and a character, one character will say to another, why are we even here? Like, what are we doing here? And I sometimes that catches me and I say, yeah, what are we doing here? They don't want to be here, or like, this is dumb. Why are we having this conversation, essentially? You know, like, and it sort of is a check. Like, so sometimes that subconscious, like the characters know they're in the wrong place or they're having the wrong conversation. So I've sort of started to notice that with amusement on the writing side, if I'm ever kind of in that trap of like, oh yeah, I'm trying to make something happen, but the characters, like, they know, which sounds really woo-woo and weird, but it's a writer thing. I don't know.
No, not at all. I think that sometimes your characters are definitely signaling to you when something is wrong or when something is right, and you have to, oh, yeah, you thought you were going there, but go there. Before we go back to Dave, would either of you like to call out any especially egregious piece of media that has done this terribly?
I will not. Because I know at some point we're all guilty.
Yeah, so. I'm always worried too that, like, oh, I'm going to work with this person someday.
Yeah, right. Exactly.
You know, just be careful. Drew McQueenie.
No, I don't.
So he used to do movie reviews for Ain't It Cool way, way back in the day. And then he became a director. He did Doctor Strange for Marvel and some other stuff. I saw him talk at the Austin Film Festival a few years back. And he was talking about, yeah, I said a lot of shit about a lot of people. And then you meet those people and you forget the shit that you said about them.
They don't forget, though.
No, they do not.
So being open to, like, character changes and stuff, what weren't they going to kill Jesse, like, very early on in Breaking Bad? And they didn't. So how do you, like, you might have something planned for the character. How flexible do you keep yourself to the story and what that character might offer that maybe you didn't see to begin with?
Mm. I think it kind of goes back to what Bonnie was saying a minute ago about kind of knowing where you need to land, knowing where you need to end up for the story that you want to tell. And for, you know, the themes that you're trying to bring out, the questions maybe that you're trying to raise and maybe gesture towards an answer to. So I feel like, you know, if you have sort of like a start point, I like to think about it sometimes like a Google Maps kind of situation. You plug in your beginning destination and you plug in your ending destination, and then it might give you four or five different ways to get there, depending on like traffic flow or depending on whatever, or like all of a sudden there's an accident and you need to take a detour and it's going to give you some other options to go. But you still anchored, right? You still started somewhere and you're still going somewhere. So it's not like you're just, you know, you started off and you were trying to get to, let's say, Austin, and you end up in, I don't know, Los Angeles or something like that, right? We're like still on the path towards that ending destination, but there can be that flexibility as you go through, right, on the route that you get there, depending on kind of what comes up in the story. So I don't know. That's sometimes how I like to think about it.
I think it's also important to, like, know your own process. Like, for me, mm-hmm. I know I am 100% when I get somewhere in the middle of Act 3, and when I'm doing I'll do a big picture outline and everything will look cool. And then I'm doing the detailed outline where I'm starting to put in snippets of dialogue. And somewhere in Act 3, I'm going to be like, oh man, I see how there can be just such a better ending than I had in the big picture outline, because I figured so many different little things out about the characters and they've taken like little detours along the way.
That's happened to Dave more times than I can count.
Right. Yeah. And like, thankfully, if it happens in the detailed outline, it doesn't happen in the draft. But just like, I expect it now. I just expect at some point in Act 3 in the detailed outline, I'm going to junk everything that comes after the midpoint and start over again.
Okay, this sounds like a joke and like I'm busting on Dave, but I'm actually not. It's a serious question. So what happens if you get the detailed outline and you agree, this is what the story should be, I've gone through the characters, I've made all the micro changes, and now I have this story, And then, you know, we've done that with Dave, but then within that draft, his version of those characters start making a lot of different micro decisions. And then the same thing happens to him, but it's not on the outline level. It's actually in the draft. And we're like, well, shit, now I've got 25% of this book left and I don't agree with the story. So what do you do in that situation?
I think it kind of depends. Like, if you're the kind of person who can figure it out in the outline, it's like giving yourself more time there. But if you're generally the kind of person who is going to figure that out in the draft, I think you just have to say, okay, that is how my brain works. So how do I get through the draft to that point in the story as fast as possible so that I can see where I'm going to be so that I know, because I know I'm going to have to go back and do some rewriting.
For me, it's I kind of think back to when I was playing as a child. I played with action figures and I'd like, you know, have a whole story I was making up as I went. And when I'm writing, it's completely different than when I'm doing an outline. I'm like in their heads, I'm in their world, and I'm seeing things differently. And sometimes I'm seeing things like, holy crap, why did I think that was a good idea when this is so much better? And I'm not going to say that my way is always better. Like, I might get lost in the story or whatever, but definitely part pantser in that way that I need to do it in the story at some point. It's going to change.
Yeah, I think that's really the key, right? It's sort of always keeping that flexibility in mind, right? Always knowing that, I mean, and sometimes people do, right? They spend so much time on the pre-writing that they never actually are getting to the page, and you want to get to the page because that's really where the story is going to happen. And also knowing that sometimes you can have the best plan in the world, but once you do start writing, it doesn't feel right for some reason, right? Once you get those characters in motion, you get them in. And sometimes that means you need to go back to the outline and maybe you need to do a little bit more thinking there. So there's always, like, I like to be like, there's always this give and take, right? There's this flow that happens between kind of like the planning brain and then like the writing brain, like David was just talking about, like where you're sort of in the world, you're immersed, you're with the characters, but then you can kind of like almost like pull out of that and go back to the analytical side if you need to, and like rethink some things and come up with some strategy. That's where like I find story feedback super helpful, because sometimes you need help like pulling out of the story enough to be able to see kind of like what's going on and help you think through alternatives sometimes.
Collaboration like, for the win. Helpful.
Yeah, 100%.
What's a good way to get story feedback if you don't like have a community of other writers or whatever? Like, are there ways that you all know that you can do that? Finding maybe beta readers, really early beta readers? I don't know.
If you don't have a community of other writers, going to writing conferences and just meeting even a couple people. When I started out, I had like one friend who I met at a writing conference, and it was just enough. She could give me feedback and tell me what she liked and didn't like, but I could see how what I was writing was hitting somebody else. So like looking for that, I mean, that's always something that is helpful if you can build that into your life. But if you absolutely positively don't have someone who you can collaborate with, working with an editor is another way to do it, because that, especially a developmental editor, whose job it is to help you see where your story is working and where your story is not working, it's expensive, but it is a way to do it. A lot of the AI tools out there do not do a good job at all of developmental editing. And even if they give you sometimes good feedback, they'll give you bullshit that you should not listen to. And if you're just starting out, you won't know the difference. Yeah. Inappropriate advice, right?
Yeah, it's not just it's not just that the LLMs like do hallucinate or just like flat out lie sometimes. It's that they're very convincing, and if you don't know, like how would you know? I mean, they're like that asshole friend that you have that just never blinks when he's lying to your face, and so it's like, oh, it comes off as so believable. And I can see that being a big trap, because then you have to unlearn things and you don't really know. Bonnie, this question is for you. Like, we highly always encourage people to get a developmental edit before the book is done. You know, like get it in the outline stage, because that'll really help you. And that's how we do everything, which like we really save a lot of headaches by never having to do gross rewrites in the post-production. They're always found in the pre-production stage. But if you're learning to write, if you are still on the amateur side, even though it's a more expensive way to do it, would you suggest getting a developmental edit when your book is done, because you're going to get so much more feedback on your actual writing? Or do you think it's better to still get it in the pre-production, even if you're in the learning stage?
I would absolutely get it in the pre-production, just because if you have a 20-page outline, the amount of revision you're going to have to do when you get feedback on it is so different than if you've written a 300- or 400-page draft. And like in the outline, you're not mired down in details that you're already attached to. If you can find someone, if you can hire a developmental editor to do it, it's much cheaper to have them just look at the outline, and they're going to give you much better advice. If you have a friend who reads in the genre who could look at your outline if you can't afford that and just like let you know where they're confused or where they don't understand why something is happening, that's another way to actually get some help. There's a trick you can use in terms of finding plot holes where you actually start at the last scene and go backwards for everything that happens in each scene or chapter of the story. Is there something before that that you can show is a cause, so that you at least know that you've got your causality down and that your story is solid in terms of it actually making sense? And that's not better than getting a developmental editor or another writer to look at your outline, but it is something that you can do to kind of learn to recognize some of those problems in the outline that you might be blind to, especially when you're new. But yeah, it's always cheaper time and money wise to get help in the outline than to get help in the draft.
That's also true in if you are using AI for developmental feedback, an outline, okay, a full draft, way harder because of memory issues. You know, like the yellow sweater that you talk about on page 21 is relevant, you know, on page 318, but Claude don't remember that. humans are remarkable in that way. We can remember some little detail where, you know, if the storyteller was sharp enough to hang a lantern on it and bring our attention as the audience to it, then we automatically remember it at the moment when we're supposed to. But, you know, Claude is basically Dory. You know, it's really present in that conversation, but 5 minutes later, it's like, wait, what were you talking about? And then you get frustrated. We were just talking about this, Claude. So, yeah, smaller is better if you are getting feedback. You can give a chapter and say, hey, what are some things I can do better? And the more specific mm-hmm. questions, the better, always, with AI. But also just know that it only has the context that you give it. And if you give it a chapter, it only has context on that chapter. So it can't give you advice on how that chapter fits into a larger narrative. It can give you advice on how that chapter is landing as a standalone unit of story.
Actually, I have a question for Shannon. Shannon, as you're teaching people, as you're teaching new writers, and you're seeing the struggles that they're having in terms of both getting their story done, getting their story unstuck when they get stuck, are there specific editing techniques or things that you recommend that people do, especially when they're first starting out?
That's a really great question. In terms of, I mean, I always think that having a human read your work, just kind of tying back into the conversation, is so helpful. So maybe going to a writing group, and even if you're not bringing, this may be a good one. Even if you're not bringing your own work to be read and to be, you know, essentially up for critique or up for feedback, listening to what is going on with other people's work and really trying to learn from what others are saying about someone else's work, and then trying to take that back and saying, okay, am I doing these same things? Is this thing that this person is saying about my friend's work over here, is that something that I can observe in my own writing? You know, so even if it's not, you know, if you're in a writing group or you're in a writing community and you're listening, or you're able to listen in on a feedback session, it can be really instructive, you know, because you're able to understand, how do we read story critically? How do we really read it with that eye to, is this working? Is it not working? How is it landing emotionally? I mean, kind of going back to the AI tool, I think one of the things that you definitely get working with a human being, whether it's another writer, whether it's an editor, is that emotional. Like, is the story actually meaning something to somebody else, a human on the other end, right, who's your audience? So I think that's really important. And, you know, I'm a huge fan of just being a student of the craft. Be a fan of the craft, you know, as you're learning, just everything you can read about the craft, read good stuff, read bad stuff, and try to figure out how you would make it better. I think that's another thing, even if you're trying to almost like self-teach. You know, Sean, you asked the question before about like, are there egregious? We all have those things that we're like, I really wish they had done X, Y, Z in that story because this is really making me mad. Figure it out, right? How would you fix it? And why would you make those choices? And I think that just doing some of those kinds of activities as you're starting to learn, it not only makes you a better writer on the front end, but it also helps you to learn how to self-edit as you're working through the process, right? So you can kind of start to anticipate as you get more experience, you'll start to anticipate, oh, I know they're gonna have something to say about this. This scene isn't working. I know it's not working. I know I'm gonna have to fix it. So those are just some of the things that I found can be helpful for students as they're learning.
Now, how do you determine how many characters your story should have? And how many you should focus, and not necessarily how many they have, they're gonna be thousands, yeah. But how many should you focus on in a book or a show, whatever you're doing, movie, so it doesn't get too overwhelming or too confusing because you have so many characters, like in Stephen King, The Stand or something, where you kind of forget who somebody is. I mean, we've been guilty.
You eventually have to put a bomb in the closet when you have that, yes. That
many characters. Whoops. I always kind of like to go back to the principle of like no more than absolutely necessary, I think is really kind of key. I mean, I know on the screenwriting side, they'll be like, could you consolidate these three characters, please? Because like they maybe all have like one or two lines, you know, how economical can you be while still telling the story that you want to tell? So what, you know, it's sometimes you have to cut somebody, right? Sometimes you have to like make those choices, or like all of a sudden three characters become one character because you just don't have the bandwidth to kind of track all of these people. So I think it's as few as necessary, maybe is the best way to put it. I don't know, Bonnie, what you might think about that, but that's sort of my general rule.
100%. It's just like, what's the minimum number of characters you need to tell the story? And like, how do you make sure that like every character has a purpose in the story? And if they don't, it doesn't matter how fun they are. Like they need to go in another story.
Yeah, it also helps to work with people like Bonnie and Shannon, who are like, away with your fancy ideas and too many characters, because that is so craft focused. And you know, craft focused, if it's the right kind of craft and the right kind of prism, is just another way for saying audience focused, experience focused. Mm-hmm. That it's because it's very easy for us as creators to put ourselves first. And if we're trying to create lasting things that matter to an audience, especially in a commercial sense, then we have to pay attention to the craft because the craft revolves around the experience.
Now, is there, you said as many that are necessary. Is there any, do you look at characters as what function they serve? Like this is antagonist, this is, you know, friend, or the different roles that they play, or like what's a good rule of thumb for people?
I like to say like there's two ways to do this, that I use both of them at the same time, and I'm interested, Shannon, in how you do it. But there's like the formal roles, like antagonist, protagonist, contagonist, right? And then like the hero's journey archetypes, and like every story system has like its own, well, here's the roles that you have to tell this kind of a story. But then there's also like, what are you trying to do with the story? It's like, if the goal of the story, if like the heart of the story is to show, even though it's not like the main thread, it's running through everything, is to show the bonding between this character and their dog, I'm going to go like, what characters do I need to actually put the characters in situations where I can just like increase those bonding opportunities? So looking at it from like an archetypal level in terms of like what those traditional roles are, but also what are the roles that you personally need to tell this very specific kind of story that you're trying to tell?
So like, so you might have like somebody in distress just to show the heroes, you know, what they'll do to help somebody in need. So you might add that type of character. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah. And again, going back to what Shannon said about being economical, it's like, how can you use the characters you have to the maximum? Like, do you need someone to like be the abuser of the dog? It's like, well, maybe the villain should also be the abuser of the dog, right? Or someone who's working with a villain, one of the villain's henchmen. It's like, don't add a separate person if you don't have to, if you can find someone who can fulfill that purpose.
But sometimes, I'm sorry, go ahead, Bonnie.
No, I was just going to say, Shannon, you might have some more thoughts on that.
I would just say, kind of going along with that, that the more you can almost like layer roles in a way, the richer those interactions become. And remember also that a character may shift roles in a scene, right? So an antagonist is just anybody who's getting in the way of what, I mean, there is an overarching antagonist of the story, generally speaking. But you could have a scene where the person who was your sidekick character is all of a sudden in an antagonistic role because they're getting in the hero's way, right?
Succession.
Yeah, exactly. So, you know, just kind of understand, like, it's great to understand and like know and love your archetypes, right? And really kind of understand what function do they serve in the story, but also understanding that as the story is moving, those relationships can almost like change position, right? You can have people rotating into other roles as you move through the story, just depending on what's happening. But I love what Bonnie was saying about layering. You know, if you can have the antagonist also do the work of helping to showcase a certain aspect about your character is always good.
And sometimes you just need body count. So sometimes you just need a walk-on character to do something and, you know, take something that's not an ensemble cast where there's like a lot of main characters, but something like one of my favorite limited series of the last many years is 1883. That was just such a extraordinary piece of writing and directing. And you have a lot of characters on there, you know, because it's the whole Oregon Trail. These people are all going here. But you have the main characters, and then you have people in the background. And in a situation like that, those walk-on characters are there to, like, prove the point that there's this big party, but also to kind of embody the danger, right? And so you always know, like, okay, we've seen this character in the background for 3 episodes. He just got a speaking line. He's getting a bullet to the face before this episode is over. Like, because that's it. They're, and that just shows you how important character is. If he just took a bullet to the face without that line of dialogue, you know, but if he says something like, what a beautiful morning. Dude, that dude is so dead. Rock to the back of the head, right? Because we've just experienced life with him. We just know that he's appreciating his life. So that means it's going to hurt a little bit more when we see him die. And so if he's just in the background, oh, Beardy just took a bullet, that doesn't really matter as much. But if Beardy has a line of dialogue, then we feel it just a little more. So I think sometimes you just need characters to exist, and they are fodder, and that kind of sucks for that character. But we bring them into this world, we can leave them. So I think that if you are going to have those walk-on characters, do your very best to make them real and embodied in the little time that you have them. And since we already brought up Stephen King's The Stand once, let's do it again. Stephen King is exceptional at this. He is so good at giving you 1 to 5 paragraphs to bond with somebody, and then he'll kill them. And then you're like, oh man, old lady Rudemeyer, shit. You know, and The Stand is really great at this, because as Captain Trips is spreading across the country, you know, he's going from person to person to person to person, and just giving you this very, very little time with them before the irony is there. Oh, you know what's happening. You know what's happening. I read that book when I was, I don't know, I want to say 11 years old. I haven't read it since. And I still remember that sequence very vividly. And that's like, you don't need a lot of space sometimes to create really compelling character work.
My favorite example of that, just as like a humorous example of that, is if you all know the Lego Batman movie, there's a character at the beginning who's like, he's leaving his job and he's like, nothing bad ever happens to me. And then boom, like, yes, it is exactly. As clear as like, what I love about that particular movie is it's absolutely like, if you want to look at story structure and you want to look at sort of the rules of storytelling, they just bring it all up to the surface and just make sort of make light of it, but you can see what's going on there, right? Here's this like character who's literally there just to like introduce your antagonist, you know, and like have the Joker like show up, and it's all kind of just, yeah, it's a great example. It's hilarious. I happen to love that movie for that reason. And actually, that's another thing I tell a lot of my writing students: if you want to really see structure, particularly on the screenwriting side, but I think just generally story, watch children's movies, like especially Pixar, Disney stuff, Lego. The Lego Batman movie is a great one, because the story structure tends to be closer to the surface because it is for a younger audience. You can kind of get to see how it's put together a little bit more clearly. It tends to follow the beats really by the minute, you know, like it's gonna, you know, inciting incident is gonna happen like 10 minutes in, like, you know, it's all there. So yeah, that's just
a
tip
if
you
like movie?
Watching that. Yeah, me?
Yeah.
Oh gosh, I don't know. I love them all. I don't know that
even,
I have a favorite.
Even the dinosaur one.
Okay, maybe not the dinosaur one as much, but I do enjoy. Yeah.
Bonnie, Dave, do either of you have a favorite Pixar?
I love Monsters, Inc. I haven't seen a couple of them still, but Monsters, Inc. is like one of my favorite movies.
Dave.
I loved Inside Out too.
Yeah.
If I was choosing on my own, I'd say Up, just for the beginning mm-hmm. sequence alone,
yes.
which did amazing things with 10 minutes. Otherwise, though, I'd say the movie I've watched the most, and it's simply because it's the first movie my son watched as a baby and loved it, was Cars, the first one.
Mm-hmm.
That's a really good movie.
Through that phase
it is good.
I'm like, if I never see Cars again, it's too soon.
I didn't like the second
Pixar,
one.
But Cars,
yeah.
I've seen Cars enough.
I think you should watch it again.
No. Yeah. My favorite is Ratatouille.
Ratatouille's awesome.
I just love Ratatouille.
Awesome.
I think the character work in Ratatouille is exceptional. I love the theme mm-hmm. that anyone can create art. It doesn't matter where it comes from. And that shot, I just watched this over the weekend again, too. I watched Ratatouille a couple of days ago. And that shot, it gets me every time. I've seen the movie 10 times, and I still get weepy when Anton Ego takes the bite of Ratatouille, and he's back in his childhood. Yeah. And then you get the voiceover of his review. Oh, that shit is so A-plus writing.
So good.
So what are some of the ways that people can create a memorable character, but also, you know, something unique and memorable, but something that still is grounded in, you know, relatability or something? Like, mm-hmm. how important is that to mix those two things? Like, is there any rule of thumb, like, the more over-the-top somebody is, like, say, Negan from The Walking Dead, he's just bashing people's heads in, but then he might have this tender moment later on that, like, has to be a little, it does a little bit of the moving him to a closer to a normal person so he can relate a little. I don't know. Is there any rule of thumb there that maybe the more outrageous they are, the more of a humanizing thing or grounding thing they need?
Mm-hmm. I think it kind of depends on what you're trying to do with the character, because a lot of times larger than life characters are not the main character of the story. They're actually, the main character will be more of an everyman or a more realistic character who's surrounded by larger than life characters. And that's like a very common entertainment experience, because like the standing character who's more realistic for us gives us the opportunity to be surrounded by all of these over the top characters. So like, if you're trying to do that, like, maybe you give them, like, little glimpses of humanity, but you, like, really focus more on the over-the-topness because you're going for that, like, fun experience of just being surrounded by people who are just, they have, like, all of these insane, like, compared to what you would experience in real life, right? They have these, like, really exaggerated personality traits, and they'll do outrageous things. Whereas, like, if your main character is an over-the-top character, and I'm thinking of, like, Mauricio is, like, one that will all, a lot of the audience will be familiar with. It's like he does have to be a lot more humanized, because even though he's over the top, we're going to be in his head all the time when we're reading his stories. And so we have to kind of really feel that. So like thinking about why you've put the over the top character versus the realistic character in the story actually can be like the compass that you use to decide, well, like, how much vulnerability do I need, and like, how realistic, like, do I need to actually show how he felt about his wife and kids, or is that something we don't care about because we just love the crazy shit he says all the time?
Well, I think it's two things. I think Mauricio is a great example because he is so over the top, and he could very, very easily become a cartoon. And the more over the top character you have, the more cartoonish they can be. So you have to ground them, and you can ground them in behavior, and you can ground them in engagement. So with Mauricio, we give him, like, he is a monster, but he will never ever harm a child, and he will fuck you up if you threaten a child. So that's something we can get behind as a reader. We're like, oh, he just did these horrible, horrible things, but he's going to save little Timmy again. And so that's great. But also, think about how much attention, Dave, we put into the reading experience of Mauricio. We make sure that he's fun to read. So you can't have all the darkness, and then it's just, that's too much. You have to have, like, there's a lot. He handles life with humor. He looks at life as this is fun. This is a game. And so that's a little more inclusive to the reader than just observing the manic, crazy, you know, killer, right? So I think that you have to pay attention to the human moments, but you also have to be very aware of what the reader experience is when spending time in that character's head.
So speaking of, like, main characters, I think there's two kinds that come to mind that are challenging to write, and one of them is like an everyday or everyday man or woman character that's kind of like an avatar for the audience. Maybe their life is a little boring or whatever, and then you might have a disaffected, moody teenager that everything sucks and the world is doomed. If you're writing one of those as your main character, how do you make them not be boring or not be too depressing?
Go ahead.
No, I was gonna say, I love this question. Go ahead, Bonnie.
I was just gonna say, like, Neo is a fantastic example of this, because, like, literally the only thing you know about him is that he has a day job as a programmer, he hacks at night, and there's this noodle shop that he really liked that turns out to be fake, and that's literally all you know about him as a human being, except that he has the same existential angst that everybody has experienced, of like, the world is not right. The things that are normal about my life that I hate, it's like everybody accepts them, but I don't want to accept them, right? So he is actually the embodiment of this emotional experience of dissatisfaction in modern life that everybody who watches that movie has had.
He also helps his neighbor take out her garbage.
That's true.
Oh, that is true. So a little bit of sympathy.
Save
there.
The cat.
Yeah. Save the trash.
The moment. Yeah, save the trash moment.
Next door. He saved her cat.
Yeah. So
I love that.
Every man characters are, like, you really have to tie them into a universal experience and, like, really give the reader, like, no friction in terms of getting into their head, like, nothing about them that would be objectionable or make the reader go, like, oh yeah, but I don't want to be 100% in their head. But also just, like, really tie them to an experience that the reader's like, I feel this all the time. I have no problem understanding exactly how he feels all the time. And then everything else that's cool about being Neo, once you actually are in his head, is actually what's happening to him, right? This whole experience of discovering that he can have godlike powers and that reality isn't real, and like all these wish fulfillment elements, like, because you've bonded with him through that experience of like, wow, what does my life suck? It's like you want to be with him even when things get really bad.
Now the second part of the question, the moody teenager, everything sucks sort of character, how do you write them in a way where the audience is still sympathetic to them? Like, because if they whine too much, then the audience will be like, I hate you too. Like,
I think that Inside Out 2 actually might be a great example of that, of doing that really well. Because, you know, like, every adult who's kind of reading a YA novel where you might have a protagonist who's in that situation, we've all been there, right? I mean, we've all had that experience. We all know what that's like, to kind of feel like you don't know how to handle what the world is giving you. But what I think that movie did so well was kind of give you that sense of the inner landscape of, like, I don't know what's happening, right? It's like Riley, she doesn't understand what's going on with her, and she's just trying to navigate this crazy new world where all of these things are happening, and things that she took for granted are kind of getting pulled away from her or are being put in jeopardy. So I think that's part of it is, and they can't be one note. I think that maybe the other thing that I would say is there needs to be some kind of a break in the moodiness to show us that there is hope for this character to fix whatever that is that's going on internally, right? That kind of like transformation that we're looking for by the end of the story, whatever that's going to be, we kind of have this hope that there's a path for them to go where some of those elements, like that might be how they're responding to the world right now, but that's not actually who they are, if that makes sense, right? There's something else that we're like looking to uncover that kind of gets beyond that reactivity or that.
If that character is surrounded by people who can kind of see through their shit.
So, yes. Yes.
Phil and Lord, who did the Lego movie and have what I understand is the most amazing script for the Han Solo movie before Ron Howard took it over. You know, and they did the Lego movies. Like, these guys are great. These guys took Cloudy with a Chance of Meatball, this like throwaway kids book, and made a legitimate movie out of it. They're really good at what they do. And they had a Netflix movie called, I think it's, is it Meet the Mitchells, maybe? And same thing, you've got this moody teenager, but she's with her family, and because her family is constantly responding to her, and they have history with her, they still have hope, right? So you can kind of, as proxy, you're in there with the family, and you're like, okay, this is a phase, right? So you have all the external things that are happening, the robots chasing them, it's the end of the world, whatever, but it's the family dynamic. And that allows the moody teenager to have more than one dimension because of the prism of her family.
Mm-hmm. And that's actually, those are two really different ways to do the same thing, right? Inside Out did it by showing what was going on in her head by personifying like all the different forces going on in her psyche. And then the outside of like having all these different relationships show facets of her personality. Right, it's like there's two different ways to show like who the person really is, while you're also seeing their behavior being really bad.
Yeah, but I love the idea of using like the environment, right? Who else is observing the character? Because the audience, even if we can't get into the head of the main character, we probably can identify with somebody, you know, who's around them. You know, we can kind of get into the parents' head and we can kind of see through their eyes. So always giving that audience like a place to go, I think, is really helpful. You know, like whose eyes do we want to be looking through in a particular scene so that we get a viewpoint on this character that's helpful. If we really are if we're really creating a challenging character, sometimes it's helpful to have that audience proxy, right? Like somebody else in the room that we can kind of like, okay, we can get into their head and we can kind of look at this character from that perspective. It's a little bit easier sometimes that way.
Okay. Is there anything else that I didn't ask that you think is really good for people to pay attention to when it comes to this?
I think just as kind of a last note on this, maybe we've gotten into this a little bit in different ways, but kind of thinking about a character and the way that they're relating to their world and as you're setting them up in your story of almost like having these two drivers, right? There's the thing that they think is going to solve their external circumstance. And then there's the thing that's going on inside that actually the broken part that needs to get fixed. We often talk about this as character want and character need. What actually has to happen to fix this person is usually not the thing they think, right? It's usually not the external, like, oh, if I just get a new job or I just move to a new city, that's going to solve my whole life, right? Because there's something internal that even if they made that change, the cycle's going to perpetuate. So as you're thinking about your characters, sort of think about that inner landscape. Like, make sure that you kind of know where the broken parts are, right? Like what's going on inside that's really going to be the thing, like Bonnie was saying earlier, that by the end we want to see that transformation happen.
Okay. Well, I appreciate you all being with us, Bonnie Johnson and Shannon Valenzuela. Is there anywhere people should look for you all? I should have asked this ahead of time. Like, website or anything?
You're getting it slowly, Dave.
I'm slowly. I'm very
slow. You know what? To make you feel better, I think, failed at the beginning of the conversation to mention that Shannon is a creative writing professor. Like, so she's not just, like, throwing shit at you guys. Yeah. Like, she comes from a deep well of experience where, like, I did say that she walks the walk and talks the talk. So she, you know, as soon as we actually finish this, just for a little bit of inside baseball at home, as soon as we finish this, we're actually, me and Bonnie and Shannon are all talking about actually the writing this novel around this pilot. So, like, I love being able to write with somebody who is so incredibly creative and can articulate that creative process, because that's not always natural for all of us. And so, yeah, there will be a lot more from Shannon coming, but we have to build things.
Yeah.
Okay. And if you want more good stuff, authorvelocity.com, that is where we put all of our tools, and we're going to have a membership that you can join up. There will be more on that soon when we have it all ready to go. Thank you for watching and listening, and we will see you next time, where we're going to get more into the mechanics of making the book, or writing the right publish and repeats. So we're going to talk about the publishing part. Thank you.
Bye, everyone.
Shadows of the Sunshine State, redacted is his home. Lives a man named David Wright, who pens the great unknown. Diet Coke runs through his veins, a decoy wallet keeps him rich. Paranoia fuels his pen, and creativity's his niche. Write, publish, repeat.